On my first few visits to Paris in the middle 1960s, I always made it a point to pop into the Louvre to see the Mona Lisa. Drawn in the first instance by the painting's mystique, the most famous painting in the world, that enigmatic smile, that captivating presence, I soon came to be more interested in the crowd surrounding the picture than in the picture itself. These are usually stereotyped as camera-laden Japanese tourists or some such, but in fact, they were only a small percentage of those rising on their tiptoes, craning their necks, trying to get a glimpse of her Mona-ness. The gathered throng had come not to see a painting, but to peer at a celebrity. They were aesthetic paparazzi. The only tragedy was that you were not allowed to get your camera out. What a missed opportunity to have one's picture taken with such a famous lady. The history of this painting is a little obscure, but it most likely dates from Leonardo's residence in Florence between 1503 and 1505. By contemporary standards, the picture was technically remarkable for its use of sfumato, in which the background dissolves in form, giving a mysterious blending of light and shade and an unearthly timelessness. But the smile for which Mona Lisa was to become renowned did not strike its first onlookers as remarkable. Indeed, a contemporary manual describing correct deportment for young ladies recommends just such a look. Close the mouth at the right corner, it says, with a suave and nimble movement, and open it on the left side, as if you were smiling secretly. I love to imagine young Renaissance ladies practicing their smiles in front of each other. How's that? Too suave and maybe not nimble enough. Maybe you should try it again. A number of commentators, both ancient and modern, have maintained that the reason for La Gioconda, as she's called, apparent bemusement, is that she's actually a self-portrait of the artist in drag, which a computer expert in 1997 claimed he could prove by superimposing Leonardo's face over that of his supposed subject. Perhaps that's why Leonardo loved the picture so much that he hardly relinquished it. He carried it with him for decades on his travels, until sometime in the 1530s he sold it to François I of France for the enormous sum of about £60,000. And from that time onwards, the portrait was in possession of the kings of France until it was deposited in the Louvre early in the 18th century. It became an immediate favorite of the crowds at the new gallery, and its fame grew as the 19th century went on. On the morning of August 21, 1911, the Louvre was closed, as it always was on Mondays. Nevertheless, a staff of some 800 people might be found within the building's massive confines. Sometime, it's not quite clear when, between 7 and 8:30 in the morning, while one of the attendants in the Salon Carré had gone for coffee and the other one was sleeping, someone walked into the gallery, took the Mona Lisa off the wall, and vanished. In time, some 60 police officers were dispatched. Art lovers coming out of the Louvre were searched. Railway stations were patrolled. But by the time the police got there, it was too late. The thief had had time enough to get away. Where did she go? Who took her? Reports in the newspapers treated the case as abduction or kidnapping rather than as a case of mere theft. The Paris Journal referred to her as whisked away. Le Figaro mourned the loss and suggested that an obituary would be appropriate, while the usually highbrow Revue de Deux Mondes suggested that Mona Lisa herself would have been deeply amused at the stir that her disappearance had caused. The police were absolutely desperate for a quick arrest. Pablo Picasso, who'd been the unwitting purchaser of some statuettes stolen from the Louvre, was questioned, and his friend, the poet Apollinaire, was actually accused and jailed for a week before the complete absence of evidence forced his release. When they were brought before a magistrate, the pair of artists were so terrified that they wept copiously. When the Louvre was reopened a week later, tens of thousands of people, including Franz Kafka and Max Brod, queued for hours to enter the Salon Carré simply to gaze at the empty space where the Mona Lisa had hung. It was enough to make a French philosopher, a Sartre, or a Lacan, who curiously was Picasso's doctor, trill with delight. If Mona Lisa had been a compelling presence, she was even more fascinating in her absence. As Gertrude Stein observed, though in a different context, it was a time when paintings were trying to escape from their frames. Trust the Mona Lisa to take this literally. The newspapers, of course, were ferociously critical. The French love blaming. The director of the museum and the chief attendant from the Salon Carré were fired. Hoaxes were posited. Suspicious eyes were cast on the Germans. Alphonse Bertillon, who had recently invented fingerprint identification, was called in and lifted an absolute beauty from the abandoned frame of the picture. But unfortunately, he couldn't match it to any of those he had on file because it came from the wrong thumb. In fact, it didn't take a Sherlock Holmes to figure out what had happened. If the lady had vanished, it had to have happened quickly, and only an expert could have done that because the Mona Lisa had only recently been remounted on the wall using a very complicated system with four iron pegs. If you knew how to do it, the picture could come off in a matter of seconds. But as the police were to demonstrate, if you didn't know the trick, it could take two men up to 5 minutes to get a picture off the wall. Somebody had known how to do it. Where to look? It was probably an inside job. How about one of the team of people who'd reinstalled the picture only a year before? Giuseppe Perugia, an itinerant Italian picture framer, had been one of a team who was responsible for the picture's rehanging. He was interviewed, but say, unlike the director of the Louvre, he was never fingerprinted. Why should he be? He wasn't important enough. Everyone had agreed that the picture was taken by a criminal mastermind, either stolen on behalf of a reclusive and ruthless American millionaire, or held to ransom. In fact, though, it was this unprepossessing Italian who'd simply walked unobserved into the gallery, taken the picture and removed it from its frame, and strolled out with it hidden under the white smock worn by so many of the museum's staff. And for over 2 years, Mona Lisa languished in her lover's squalid bed-sitting room before Perugia, his passion slaked, decided it was time for her to go home. And it was at this point, I suspect, that he concocted the story that was to make him an Italian national hero. Single-handedly, he claimed, he had performed a patriotic act. He was returning Mona Lisa to Italy, from which he wrongly believed she had been taken by the vile Napoleon. According to art theft investigator Richard Ellis, who was formerly the founder of the New Scotland Yard Art and Antiques Squad, it is sometimes the case that works of art are stolen for political reasons.
The Goya that was stolen, the Duke of Wellington's portrait from the National Gallery in 1961, Kenton Bunton, who was subsequently arrested for stealing the painting, was, according to him, making a statement to support the elderly pensioners against the increase in television licenses, which had just been brought in by the government, as I say, back in 1961. And there have been other instances where artworks have been stolen for that type of reason.
But as Adam Golder, who's the chief executive of AXA Art, which is one of the UK's leading art insurance companies, acknowledges, the usual goal of art thieves, like that of any other sort of thieves, is personal gain.
There is some speculation that some great works are stolen to order. That is unlikely, although it is common that people believe that. There is also a view that Interpol have, which is that quite a lot of large art thefts are related to money laundering, drug or arms dealing. And in fact, they say that it's the fourth highest ranked criminal activity at around about $5 billion.
It's an underworld currency, so they will utilise it as a commodity in its own right, and they will exchange it for other valuable goods on the black market. So it becomes a bartering tool. If you look at the Vermeer that was stolen from the Bight collection in Ireland in 1986, that was actually recovered in 1993, where it had been used by the thief as collateral for a loan that he was going to then use the money to start a bank for money laundering purposes.
Ignorant of the possible avenues for selling stolen pictures, Giuseppe Perugia wrote to a leading art dealer in Florence, Alfredo Gheri, who had recently advertised for old pictures. Signing his letter, Leonardo, the thief offered the sale of the Mona Lisa, suggesting that Gheri come to Paris to view the painting, for which he was asking approximately £60,000, which ironically was identical to its price in the 1530s. All dealers get a host of apparently cranky letters, and mostly they throw them away. Gheri almost did so too, until an obscure intuition made him pause. After all, the picture was out there somewhere. He enticed Perugia and his lady to Florence by arguing plausibly that the director of the Uffizi needed to verify the authenticity of the picture before they could proceed with purchase. And so, on Wednesday, the 17th of November, 1913, Gheri and Giovanni Poggi, director of the Uffizi, went to Leonardo's modest hotel room, where, in Gheri's words,
"He locked the door and drew out from under his bed a trunk of white wood that was full of wretched objects, broken shoes, a mangled hat, a pair of pliers, plastering tools, a smock, some paint brushes, and even a mandolin. Then, from under a false bottom in the box, he took out an object wrapped in red silk. And to our astonished eyes, the divine Gioconda appeared, intacta and marvelously preserved."
There was no doubt about the authenticity of the picture. The Mona Lisa still bore on its reverse side the identifying marks from the Louvre. At his subsequent trial, Perugia vehemently protested his innocence, maintaining that he had acted from altruistic motives. The £60,000 asking price was presumably intended to cover his expenses. He was sent to jail for the remarkably short sentence of 7 months, during which time he was treated as a national hero. So many gifts, flowers, and boxes of chocolate arrived that he had to be moved to a larger cell. Anonymous admirers sent checks, ensured he had decent coffee in the morning, paid for his meals, and generally made sure that he was thoroughly comfortable. In the meantime, the Mona Lisa made her slow way back to her adoptive home in France, stopping at a museum or two on the way to elicit the admiration of tens of thousands of Italians. It was like a royal procession. In the view of the director of the Uffizi, the Mona Lisa had never been stolen or even kidnapped. His view was that she had eloped and tried to come home. She was always a tricky lady. Surely that Renaissance smile tells you that. Indeed, Giuseppe Perugia, in one of the various and contradictory stories that he gave with regard to his motives, claimed that he'd gone into the Louvre to steal some other painting, but that as he passed her, the Mona Lisa smiled seductively at him. "Take me." Perhaps she fancied him, or was she merely looking for a way out? Women chained to uncongenial destinies often choose odd bedfellows to make their escapes. I prefer this version of the story. If it's true, I rather suspect that sometime, maybe soon, the lady will make another beeline for freedom. Remember, you heard it here first.